Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, and welcome to Medieval Lols, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. I'm Mary Wellesley.
And I'm Irina Dumitrescu.
And we're both writers, literary historians, and contributors to the paper. In this series, we're asking, was the Middle Ages funny? And to do that today, we're looking at a 1,000-year-old riddle collection that probably suggests that life in a medieval monastery was not quite as sober as we might imagine. So, Irina, can you just set us up and tell us something about the place of riddles in Anglo-Saxon culture?
Sure. So I think, you know, the first thing we have to know is that literate people in early medieval England were usually literate in Latin first. So they're having to learn this language that is foreign to English, that is, you know, of a different language family. And so you have all kinds of learned people interested in writing grammars and writing all kinds of helping aids, works on rhetoric, works on meter. They're really interested in learning Latin because Latin is the key to reading scripture. That's the thing. And if you are a monk or a bishop or a priest, that's probably something you want to be able to do. But there's something particular about England in this case. They really, really loved riddles. And riddles have a long tradition. They're an ancient form. I think a lot of people would know the Sphinx riddle to Oedipus. Greek oracles tend to speak in riddles. There's some ancient Greek collections of riddles. So this is, you know, it's an ancient form. And it's often had this sort of spiritual aspect to it. In the Bible, you have the Queen of Sheba traveling to meet Solomon and quiz him with riddles. And later Midrashic literature provides that the riddles which are not named in the Bible. And the Romans don't riddle quite as much as the Greeks, but one of the important texts for us and for the Anglo-Saxons is a work from the late 4th or early 5th century by a man who's called Symphosius. It's basically a collection of 100 riddles in Latin hexameter. And they're on different kinds of objects or natural phenomena. And they're not actually meant to be guessed. So in the manuscripts we have, they travel with the solution. So you're more supposed to admire the wit of the description. We don't know who Symphosius was. He may have been from Roman North Africa, and the name itself is a play on symposium or drinking party. So he may just be, he may be the party guy, you know, and the idea would be that at a party you would drink a lot of wine and then tell these riddles. He becomes really important in early medieval England, and you have all kinds of learned men who do their own versions of this. So Aldhelm, the abbot of Malmesbury, this is in the 7th century, writes his own riddle collection. It's 100 riddles in Latin, and they're modeled on Symphosius. And his also have the answers with them. Boniface, who, you know, was known as a bishop, who was martyred in Germany, wrote his own set of riddles on didactic topics, and they're acrostics, so the beginning of each line spells out the answer. So again, this is like a thing that learned men do, possibly to teach with, possibly because they like the genre. And then a little later, we have a couple of riddle writers we don't know very much about who seem to have kind of worked in concert. One of them was Tatwin, who wrote a collection of 40 riddles, some of which echo passages from scripture. So this is why I think they have this didactic purpose, right? They're meant to help you understand the Latin language, understand grammar better. Some of them are on grammatical topics, and understand the Bible. And then Eusebius, who knew Bede, for example, wrote 60 to complete the first 40. So they like That's the other thing. They like to have them in sets of 100 because Symposia wrote 100. So that's just the number of riddles you want to have. So this is the picture. You know, you have a lot of these Latin riddles, and there are other collections I haven't mentioned that are circulating around in England and also beyond, also on the continent. And they're just quite popular. Some of them don't have answers, but usually they do. Usually it's about the intellectual engagement with them. Then we have the Old English riddles, which are a little bit different.
What you've described doesn't sound like very rich comic territory.
No.
I mean, yeah. I'm assuming that those Latin collections are not that funny, or they are. There are moments of kind of slightly muted humor, or
They're mostly not very funny.
Okay.
No, they're more serious. They muse on qualities of nature. So, you know, they like to kind of pay attention to the paradoxes in nature. Things like the fact that ice turns into water and then turns into ice again. So that becomes a kind of...
hilarious.
My mother gives birth to me. They're more about looking at nature and at crafts and at the world in a poetic way. Yeah, they're not really funny. But some of them have suggestive little elements that you have to read very closely into the Latin. They're not really right up front. And that's also a way that the English riddles are a bit different. So the Exeter book, we've mentioned it before in this podcast. It's a collection of verse from the 10th century, probably put together in a monastic context. So we're thinking of monks as the primary audience for these riddles. And we have three groups of riddles in the Exeter book. There are different kinds of counts, but they're almost 100, depending on how you count. And they're in Old English verse. And one of the big differences is that they don't have answers, which is wonderful if you are a scholar of this topic, because you can get a lot of publications proposing different answers to the riddles. This has been a great boon to our field. Imagine if they all had answers and we had nothing to write about. And so, with some of them we know because they're translations or very closely based on Latin riddles that we have, so we can tell what was probably meant. We have one like that today that we'll talk about. But with others, you know, some of them are quite obscure or difficult, and there are all kinds of potential answers for them. And that is, you know, this collection is not as unified. They're somewhat different from each other. They often have a line at the end, like, say what I am called, Zaga Huatichate, or say what it is called. So there's a kind of call out to the reader to solve it. And, you know, there have been so many arguments. Are things sort of, are they common riddles, you know, folk riddles that have been incorporated by these monks into this collection? There are all kinds of theories, but I think we can sort of take a slice of them today and enjoy them.
Because some of the other texts in that manuscript are, I mean, we've talked about some of them before, but these female-voiced laments, and we have poems like The Wanderer or The Seafarer that listeners might know. I mean, those seem to be texts that they appear kind of more ephemeral and more rooted in a kind of, you know, if I can call it this, a sort of vernacular culture as opposed to a sort of monastic Latinate mm-hmm. culture. And so where do you sort of see the riddles as sitting kind of on that continuum, if that's a good way to conceptualize it?
Well, I think that's the thing. A lot of the poems in the Exeter book are pretty enigmatic. I think these people just really loved enigmatic poetry, which is part of what makes Old English poetry so much fun to read today. We often don't know who is the speaker, what actually happened, what's the story behind this. And that's why it's also hard to count the riddles in the Exeter book, because there are arguments made for some of the, you know, what are considered lyric poems or elegies to be riddles. I think, you know, my theory is, these people were getting trained on riddles from day one. And so when they either chose poetry or wrote it themselves, they gravitated towards enigmatic, mysterious, difficult, puzzling poetry. They really liked that. Even longer narrative verse has a lot of elements like this. Beowulf has elements like this. They liked the feeling of difficult questions being answered and having to muse on them. You know, not so much having everything explicitly, you know, laid out for them in a clear story. And is that only the monks, or is that, does that go beyond the monastic environment? I'm not sure. But I think definitely in these monastic circles, there are also later collections of quizzes and riddles. They like questions and answers. And they like this process of working something out, of meditating on something and working it out.
It feels like that's something that you see across many of the art forms. I mean, if you think about kind of the artwork, so interlaced patterns and that you see in manuscripts or in jewelry, these are incredibly complex patterns that require you to look and relook and try to sort of make out from what appears to be a mess of shapes. And actually, you know, it's several animals, or, you know, you take something like the Sutton Hoo belt buckle and you can see I think it's like something like 13 distinct different snakes or beasts within it. And it feels like that's something that we see in the literary texts and in the art, you know, that these are artworks that are produced that require very kind of careful rumination and examination.
Well, if you think about it, these people were doing the same thing week after week, right? So they might not have had the internet, but they could be just as distracted as anyone today. And so they're finding all sorts of ways to pay attention. And they also have to find ways to pay attention to scripture. And I think that's what the riddles are aiming at a little bit. We can get back to that later. But, you know, how do you pay really close attention to a text? How do you pay really close attention to the world around you? This is what the riddles aim at. At least that's the pedagogic element, but that's not all of it. Maybe there's a pleasure element too.
Yeah, I think we've perhaps been misleading listeners that what we're going to be talking about is very serious biblical exegesis, but that's not what we're talking about, is
no,
it?
No. Shall we start with the riddle, Mary?
Let's start with the riddle, yeah.
So the riddles also have different numbering. This is sometimes called Exeter Riddle 25, and we're going to be reading the editions and translations on a website called The Riddle Ages. So listeners can also go look all of these up. I'll read the Old English. Ich eo munderlik wicht, wivu mon hichte, ne abwendum nüt, neangum schäde burgsi dendra, nüm de bonam anum. Stadol min is sterbher, stonde ich on bede, neu dan ruch nat swer, ne de chwilum fulkirten u cheorles doctor, mod long meule, dat he on mech gripeth, reset mech on reodne, reavat min hervod, feieth mech on festen. Feleth sona mines jemotes, seo de mech nearwath, weef wunden lock, wet bith that air ye.
Okay, so the modern English translation from the Riddle Ages is, I am a wondrous creature, a joy to women, a help to neighbours. I harm none of the city dwellers, except for my killer. My base is steep and high, I stand in a bed, shaggy somewhere beneath. Sometimes ventures the very beautiful daughter of a churl, a maid proud in mind, so that she grabs hold of me, rubs me to redness, ravages my head, forces me into a fastness. Immediately she feels my meeting, the one who confines me, the curly-locked woman. Wet will be that eye. So what is the scholarly consensus on what the solution of this riddle is, Rina?
Well, it's obviously an onion.
Obviously,
yeah.
An onion.
I mean, it can only be an onion. It's a creature which, you know, sits on a high bed. It's got the shaggy onion roots beneath.
The strong star shaft.
Yeah, the strong. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, obviously you would have a sort of lower class girl who would come and grab it from the vegetable bed and I guess rub it. Or attack it, you know, they could also translate the word that way.
Well, sort of peeling it, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. You know, peeling the onion, cuts off the head. And she's going to start crying. I mean, I can't think what else this could mean.
Neither can I.
And I, you know, that's the line that I, you know, is often given about these riddles. There's a subset of riddles in the Exeter book that have these erotic connotations, which are not very difficult to tease out, unlike the Latin riddles, right? So is this a monastic game to see if you can think of the clean answer that, you know, to the pure, all things are pure. Are you pure enough to think of an onion or a leek or something like that? Or are you thinking of a phallus?
Yeah, I one of the best kind of explanations of this that I heard, which I loved, is the idea that you know, these are texts that are probably being circulated amongst novitiate monks, you know, young boys, basically. And it's a kind of really interesting way to test whether their mind has kind of fallen, as it were. You know, are they still pure of heart, or, you know, have they some kind of, you know, forbidden knowledge?
I'm not sure anyone was really expected to be pure of heart even back then, and even in a monastery. I think they knew that there was this aspect of human behavior, or, you know, human thoughts would go to all kinds of things. But I mean, I think it's also interesting just to look at the riddle as a poem, right? Okay, so we have a riddle with two answers. You know, one is phallus and one is some kind of allium. What else is happening in it? Because that's the interesting thing, that there's also a little bit of a story to it. The fact that it has poetic, metaphorical language makes this into something more, whether it's a sexual encounter or a garden scene. It makes it into something more than an ordinary event, which it would be in either case.
Yeah, and let's also talk about the kind of subject of the poem. I mean, this the creature, the wondrous creature, ich eum wunderliku wichte, this creature, it's not an object, and I think that's an interesting point, is speaking. This is a riddle that is not describing something in the third person.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, part of this is, that's very typical for riddles, especially the Old English riddles. You know, they often have horns, books, all kinds of things speaking and talking a little bit about how they were removed from the natural world and brought to human uses. What I find so interesting in this riddle is the violence, and that it's almost a kind of heroic encounter, right? This the woman, the churl's daughter, is called the Modlong Meule. She's like a proud woman, so it's almost like she's a warrior woman. And the verb that's being translated as rubbing in the translation, it's also like an attack. She's attacking the vegetable bed, or she's attacking the man with whom she's having a sexual encounter. But there's a sense of her almost carrying out a battle, that this heroic element, which we know from Old English epic poetry, is coming to this ordinary scene. And it's part of the sexuality, or just part of cooking, right? Because when you're cooking, you also cut up the vegetables and you do all kinds of terrible things to them. But yeah, you're right. It's sort of telling it from the perspective of the creature, as though it had a voice. And that's maybe part of the fun of these, that it gives the voice to all of these objects and or phalluses.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interestingly something that we see in a lot of Old English texts, right? And not just simply used for these comic purposes. I mean, you think about a poem like The Dream of the Rood, which is this, you know, probably one of the earliest surviving pieces of poetry in the Old English canon. And it is the story of the crucifixion from the perspective of the tree cut down to make the cross on which Christ is crucified. And there are sections of it carved in runes on an 8th century cross in southwest Scotland. So it's an extremely early poem, possibly from a period quite close to the time of the conversion to Christianity. But it's something that in some way puzzles the kind of modern sensibility, because it's a speaking tree, and that seems kind of really odd to us. But, you know, for that poem to work, for it to have an emotional power, you have to be able to understand that what we would deem inanimate objects have some kind of voice and are vested with some kind of perhaps sacral power. And that's something, what that precisely means in Anglo-Saxon culture is very difficult to pin down, but I think it's really interesting that they seem to have had this feeling that material objects could speak, and you know, it's too much to say that they would have a soul. But you know, you think about, for example, there's this wonderful object called the Alfred Jewel, which is held in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. And it's a so-called astle that appears to have attached to certain texts that King Alfred had translated into Old English and then kind of sent around the country. And it's this very beautiful gold object. And it just says around the outside of it, Alfred had me made. Or you take the Frank's casket, this amazing ivory casket in the British Museum, which again tells the story of its own creation, again in a riddle, in runes, and about how it is made from Honnesbarn whale bone. And it tells the story of the beaching of the whale and how the bones are then from the whale are then taken and made into this casket. And I think that's a really interesting, the kind of Anglo-Saxon relationship with objects is so different from our own.
I mean, you know, I have to take the fun out of everything and blame Latin instruction, because it is also a rhetorical exercise from the ancient period to compose speeches in the voices of people or objects. So ethopoeia would be a certain kind of person, like, a poem in the voice of a peasant or a woman who's been wronged or something like that. And then prosopopeia is the term for a speech in the voice of an object. So at least the monks, I think there's a good chance. We don't have absolute proof for this, but I think there's a good chance they might have been practicing something like this in the classroom. But it seems to go beyond that. It does seem to be a sort of general sensibility in the period to look at the world as being alive and to be able to make this shift in perspective, right? How do things look if you are a horn? And you're not just an object for human use, but you're torn from the head of an animal and you're polished and you're put to the lips of various people and you're, you know, filled full of mead or wine or beer or whatever and passed around. So that I do think there's a sensibility there that we don't have quite as much because we're so human focused.
And which I think is very kind of pressing today. It invites us to think a little bit more clearly about our relationship with the natural world.
But I would also say what's maybe a little atypical here is that while the speaker might be a phallus, the focus is also on the woman's desire.
Mm.
It's actually also kind of a passive, you know, things happen to this.
The phallic object.
This object, right? The speaker.
Yeah.
And, the first line is, I am a wondrous creature, ich um wunderliche Wicht. But the second half line is, a wee from one hichte, you know, a joy to women, or maybe the hope of women, the hopeful expectation of women. So we literally have women's desire there, right, in the second half line. And she's the one doing all kinds of things to it. She's going to feel its revenge, as it were, but it's not really clear, you know, is it her eye that's weeping at the end, or is it the eye of the speaking object? That sheds a tear, but it's a woman doing things to it for her own pleasure and for her own desire. And that's kind of unexpected, especially given that we do not have a lot of women in Old English poetry.
Yeah, it's interesting, those final lines, because when I was thinking about this morning, I said to you, oh, well, it's really just about the phallus. But actually looking at them again, I'm sort of seeing how actually there is a real focus on the woman in those final lines. And we have this description of this woman, the Huif Wundenlock, which is the woman with kind of beautiful braided hair, Wunden like wound and locks like, you know, locks. And that's a word we have that is used to describe Judith, who is from the apocryphal Book of Judith. She's this incredible, compelling, probably the most charismatic, compelling female character in the Old English poetic corpus. And it's a poem that appears alongside Beowulf in the same manuscript in the Cotton Collection in the British Library. But she's this great kind of figure of heroism. And so it's sort of interesting that the same word is used. It is a kind of, you know, suggestively it's a sort of heroic, but also implying that she's a kind of elegant figure. But then also what I love, and this is what these riddles are doing constantly, is we could also just see this as female genitalia, right? We could see the Wundenlock as being a kind of jokey way of referring to her pubic hair. And it's talking about this kind of meeting place, the fastness and the wet eye, you know, is the eye actually her vagina? And, you know, and it's wet from this phallus being, you know, pushed into it. And so it, you know, that's the, in those final lines, it really encapsulates the whole way in which this riddle is working. It's working on these multiple levels, you know, using this kind of heroic diction, but also using it for kind of comic purposes and allowing you to take whichever reading you want to take.
Any riddle is going to have some distraction and send you in the wrong direction. But I think what's so marvelous about the Old English riddles is they do that with every half line. Every half line can get you thinking about some biblical passage or some aspect of nature or some aspect of sexuality. And that's, you know, that leads to this layered experience of them, that your mind is almost like constantly going out and then coming back again and trying to come to the solution, going out and trying to come back again. And, you know, maybe that's also to do with the attention, with the way attention works, or any kind of meditation or prayer, that your mind is always wandering and then you bring it back. So you could see, you know, maybe I'm trying too hard to make these spiritually useful, but you can see how it would do that, right? How you would always sort of be in this tension between the wandering mind and the focused mind that answers the question. But maybe we can look at another riddle that's mm-hmm. Similar and yet does something a little bit different. So this is Exeter Riddle 44. And actually, Mary, would you read just the translation?
A wondrous thing hangs by a man's thigh, under its lord's clothing. In front there is a hole. It stands stiff and hard. It has a good home. When the servant raises his own garment up over his knee, he wants to greet with his dangling head that well-known hole of equal length, which he has often filled before. So the solution is a
key.
Oh, a key. A key.
Yeah. And I mean, again, you know, very similar thing, maybe even in this case, a little less metaphorical than the last riddle. We don't have any woman in here, right? And actually, maybe that's interesting to point out. We don't know if whatever hole is being filled is a woman's hole.
Yep.
That's not made clear here. Mm-hmm. It could be any hole mm-hmm. that the key enters.
Mm-hmm. And has entered many times before.
And has entered many times before. But this is, you know, this is one of these situations where, again, you know, are we reading it in, you know, in a filthy way, or are we reading it in a clean way? That's also a problem with the Bible. That's a problem with Scripture, because Scripture has all sorts of naughty elements, right? You know, there's the Old Testament story of Lot having sex with, or rather his daughters having sex with him when he's drunk. There's a riddle on that, right, in Old English. So there are these passages in Scripture which are disturbing if you're trying to lead a chaste, clean life and not think about sex. These monks would have to deal with that. And of course, greatest of all is the Song of Songs, which is highly erotic.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically Hebrew erotic poetry that somehow made its way into a sacred text and has been reframed by Christian theologians at a later date.
Yeah, as representing the love between Christ and his church, right? And the church in this sense meaning all of the believers, right? And in the Song of Songs, the lover, you know, is described as having a key, right? And sort of being on the other side of the door, and the beloved, the bride, waiting for him to enter. And her hands full of myrrh. So, you know, it's incredibly erotic. And the trick, I think, was how do you read the spirituality into this when you are, you know, and that's something that lots of Christian thinkers are very good at doing. Bernard of Clairvaux writes a series of sermons on the Song of Songs. I think they're not actually always necessarily interested in removing the eroticism from the text. And I think maybe that's a mistake we make. We tend to think monks have to be pure and clean because they're not living sexual lives. Well, some of them did anyway, right? But other than that, why do we think that they have no erotic aspect to their spirituality or to their inner life, when we know, especially in the later Middle Ages, that there are all kinds of mystics who have very erotic experiences of Christ, right? Mm-hmm. Marjorie Kemp, who we've talked about in the podcast, has a marriage, you know, she marries God the Father. She kisses Christ's, you know, feet. She has essentially, she sleeps with Christ, right?
The Austrian mystic who has a kind of mystical experience where she believes she tastes Christ's foreskin in her mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is not unusual in the later Middle Ages. And, it, you know, it's a little outrageous, but it's not seen as wrong either. It's acceptable that you would have this incredibly close relationship to God that would be described in erotic terms. Well, what if they're doing this early on, too? What if, you know, imagining Christ on the other side of the door holding the key, in this case, is, you know, it's probably not a servant necessarily, but metaphorically, this might also recall the Song of Songs for one of the monks who's listening to this or trying to solve it or...
Sure. Song of Songs, eh?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I think we should move to the one-eyed garlic seller.
I think we should move to the one-eyed garlic seller. I'll read the Old English for this.
Okay.
Wicht quam gongan ver vera seton, monio on mesle, modes notre. Hevde an eie und eran toa, und toa fet, 1200 hefda. Rich und wombe on honda toa, ermas und axle, anes weoran und sidan toa. Saga huet ich hatte.
A creature came walking to where men sat, many in a meeting, wise in mind. It had one eye and two ears, and 2 feet, 1200 heads, a back and a belly and 2 hands, arms and shoulders, 1 neck and 2 sides. Say what I am called.
Well, we've essentially given this one away already, and I think the only reason we know what it's called, what it's supposed to be, is because it's based on a Latin riddle, which has a solution, which is a one-eyed seller of garlic. You know, so you think you're sort of encountering a kind of monstrous creature that is like no human being, that has all of these heads all over, but only one eye in the middle, and it turns out to be a merchant. But of course, the Old English doesn't have this answer in the manuscript, so. Somebody just encountering it on its own might have had more ideas. But what's different about the Old English is that the creature is coming to a place where men are sitting in council. Sort of wise men are sitting around. So that's my question, is what is this? Why are these wise men here? Are these the monks? Are they the people who are supposed to guess what it is? Why has the Old English poet added this material?
I think it's kind of interesting to think about what the kind of function. I remember hearing a riddle the other day, which is one that is basically which kind of tests out your sort of your innate sexism, because it's the kind of solution of the riddle is that you have to understand that the surgeon who's described in this thing is actually a woman, and you're making this automatic assumption that the surgeon is
his father was away, the man was in an accident,
exactly,
his father
exactly.
was away,
yeah. And so I think it's kind of really interesting with a riddle like this to think, like, what is the kind of, what would be the social function of a riddle like this? Is it making you think about the human and the monstrous and thinking about your perceptions of people? I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but it's kind of intriguing to think, given that these texts are not, the way in which they've been recorded in this manuscript, they're not just kind of like ephemeral things that have been copied in little, on little scraps and, you know, tucked into the ends of manuscripts or around the edge of a, you know, of another text, like, you know, something like Cadman's Hymn, which is a very early text that appears to have sort of snuck in around some other Latin texts. You know, these have been recorded with care. And sometimes they've got a bit confused. So there are some riddles that have got runes in them, and the runes might possibly have once been the solutions, and then they've been copied and recopied by people who perhaps don't understand runes properly. And so they're not perfect. But, you know, for this riddle to be copied, it feels like it has to have meant something important to someone at some point.
So, well, there are a few things going on in here. There's a few scholars have noted that a one-eyed man in a situation where people are talking about wisdom, might have a little, you know, might recall Odin, Who knows if that's the case for the first audience of this book. It certainly recalls Odin for us, but that might be a little bit of a sort of flavor, a little suggestion, not just a monster, but maybe also a god. What I find interesting is the amount of detail and how much of the detail in this poem is actually pretty banal. You know, is a back and a belly and two hands, arms and shoulders. Most of this just describes a person. It's just the 1,200 heads that make it complicated. And then you have to know that heads can be heads of garlic as well. But I think part of the joke or the play is the wisdom lies in knowing what the question is that you have to answer. And the final line is actually, say what I am called. Megan Cavell, who started this this website that we've been quoting from and is responsible for a lot of the translations, writes in her commentary that, you know, this is often edited, you know, and changed to say what it is called by modern editors. But the poem actually asks, say what I am called. So maybe you're not supposed to guess what this creature is at all. Maybe you're supposed to say riddle, or maybe you're supposed to name the person who's saying it. And I wonder if that's a little bit of the joke on the wisdom of the men, you know, that it's a little, you know, it's sort of saying, well, these people are sitting around talking about, you know, talking about things and being all wise. But do they know what the real question is that's to be answered?
Let's go to another riddle. So this is often called Riddle 26. A certain enemy robbed me of my life, stole my world strength. Afterward, he soaked me, dunked me in water, dragged me out again, set me in the sun, where I swiftly lost the hairs that I had. Afterward, the hard edge of a knife, with all unevenness ground away, slashed me, fingers folded, and the bird's joy spread over me with worthwhile drops, often made tracks over the bright border, swallowed tree dye, a portion of the stream, stepped again on me, journeyed, leaving behind a dark trace. Afterward, a hero encircled me with protective boards, covered me with hide, garnished me with gold. Therefore, the wonderful work of smiths glitters on me, surrounded by wire. Now those ornaments and the red dye and that wondrous dwelling widely worship the protector of the people, not at all foolish in wisdom. If the children of men who wish to enjoy me, they will be the more sound and the more victory fast, the bolder in heart and the more blithe in mind, the wiser in spirit. They will have more friends, dear and near, faithful and good, upright and true. Then their glory and prosperity will increase with favor and lay down goodwill and kindness, and in the grasp of love clasp firmly. Find what I am called, useful to men. My name is famous, handy to heroes and holy in itself.
I find that interesting, that find what I'm called, or, you know, in the old English, ask what I'm called. In a sense, it's almost asking the riddle answer to keep asking. And, you know, our listeners have probably guessed this is a book. Like many of the riddles, we have this sense of it being violently pulled out of the natural world, right? We sometimes think of the trees that it takes to make books, but if this is a monastic context, they would have been very acutely aware of the animals that had to be raised and had to be killed in order to make the pages of any book. These are luxury objects.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have this wonderful description of how kind of parchment is made. Mm-hmm. You know, the hairs are being removed from the skin that has been dried out, having been soaked in lime. And then also these wonderful descriptions of the process of writing, the bird's joy, as in the feather that makes the quill. And then this lovely description of the work of writing. And this is a very pretty common metaphor, you know, talking about writing as like tracks or plowing. But here, the words being making tracks over the bright border, and being made also the description of the ink being made of a portion of the stream, and then journeying, leaving a dark trace. It's a really wonderful evocative description of writing. And then we have this lovely explanation of how, you know, very high status books, you know, often the solution of this is a gospel book or a Bible, because, you know, the implication is that this is a sacred text. A hero encircled me with protective boards, covered me with hide, garnished me with gold. And, you know, some listeners may have seen some examples of early medieval so-called jeweled bindings, but these are these incredibly high status, basically gold and jewels. There's an amazing one in the Pierpont Morgan Museum in New York, Library in New York. So these are big, flashy objects that kind of convey the, you know, the power of the text that they contain.
Well, and that's the point, that the people who make these objects in this poem become heroic, right? And, you know, we tend to think sometimes of the world of heroic battle in England or in the early Middle Ages as being very separate from the monastic world. And they sometimes say so, right? You have people like St. Guthlac, who leaves behind his army life or his military life and becomes an ascetic. But the thing is that the spiritual life is also conceived as a battle. They also, you know, think of themselves as warriors, just warriors for Christ. And here the warrior is the person who is taking the natural world and making this incredible object out of it. And I think what we also, you know, you use the word power. That comes through here because we also forget how much books represent power. They represent elite, special power. That's why the language in them is often almost thought to be magical. That's why the word grammar becomes glamour, right? Grammar is a kind of magic to them, a powerful magic. And so the person who has power over the book and who can read the book, who can open it and actually read it, is heroic. I'm struck by the word mere, which is used to describe the book at the end of the poem. Nama minis mere, my name is famous. It sounds like, you know, Beowulf is mere. This is the way you would describe a hero. But it's true of the book, and it's true of the person who makes the book or the people who make the book.
And maybe true of the riddle itself.
Yeah, so there's heroism, there's violence, but there's also pleasure, right? There's pleasure in the book, and the riddles encompass all of these. And they bring us pleasure through the riddling and through the solutions, but they also do a kind of violence to the mind or to reality by cutting it apart. And I just love the idea that there's something heroic about the process of asking and answering, about the process of thinking really hard.
Thank you, Irina.
Thank you, Mary.
If you enjoy hearing about medieval literature, you can listen to our full 12-episode series, Medieval Beginnings, right now as part of the LRB's Close Readings podcast subscription, where you'll also find the whole first series of Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones, looking at classical literature from Homer to Horace, and The Long and Short with Mark Ford and Seamus Perry on 19th and 20th century literature from Tennyson to Alice Oswald. And, as well as all that, you'll be able to listen to the three new series running this year. There's On Satire with Claire Bucknell and Colin Burrow, which looks at satirical texts from Erasmus to Muriel Spark. Human Conditions with Judith Butler, Pankaj Mishra, Brent Hayes Edwards, and Adam Schatz, which looks at revolutionary texts of the 20th century. And a second series of Among the Ancients with Emily Wilson and Thomas Jones. You can listen to all of that with the Close Reading subscription. Sign up directly in Apple Podcasts or in other podcast apps. There are links for these below.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.